It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, everyone. This is Brandon. I'm with the International Solidarity Commission of the IWW. We're talking today with Ellison, who's involved with a revolutionary union in Spain called the CNT. We're going to be talking about the feminist general strike that happened in Spain on March 8th, as well as other radical organizing that's currently happening in Spain. Ellison was also on the It's Going Down podcast a few months ago to discuss the general strike that happened in Catalonia against state repression. First of all, Ellison, welcome back. Do you want to add anything to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm in CNT, and I'm also the organizing secretary in the local federation of CNT unions in Madrid. So I take care of coordinating organizing activity. And I was also recently on the national level strike committee here in Spain for the 8th of March strike.
Great. So can you describe what the feminist general strike was? What did Spain look like on March 8th? And, you know, how is this idea of a feminist general strike similar or different to the idea of like a women's strike, for example, that's come up in the US and other places?
I'm not really sure how it might be different from the United States, because I don't live in the United States. My knowledge of US politics is limited to language. What did it look like on the 8th of March? There was a lot of small pickets, general strikes in Spain. Usually the big unions will try to close shops and make sure nobody goes to work. And people who are at work are getting pamphleted. So the big pickets at when shops are opening. So usually pickets would start at midnight and they would go to transportation hubs and things like this. And a lot of bodily blocking workers from going. Of course, it's not legal, but that's what you end up doing. You're informing about the strike, but you would go, and a lot of union members would be there to block entry to workplaces. That's how general strikes usually are in Spain. And then there are like roving pickets to workplaces that are already open to give people pamphlets and things about the reasons for the strike. This strike was a little different. And this was the feminist coordinator in Madrid made that clear to us, that they wanted it to be a little different to us as the unions. They wanted it to be a little different and less quote unquote violent than general strikes usually are. So, I mean, we contested that, saying that the police are the ones who are actually violent, not the unions. But anyway, so we maybe toned it down a little bit. The unions didn't go to transportation hubs or anything like that at the, you know, stroke of midnight. And we limited ourselves to kind of doing these maybe lighter pickets through the, in my union in particular, through the center of the city. Kind of like banging on pots and pans and putting up posters and handing out pamphlets and things like this. So you always start a strike at midnight, and that's what we did at midnight. And unlike other general strikes where I spent the entire night, all night up at pickets, most of us went home to bed. And then at 8 in the morning, there were more pickets in downtown, my union, downtown, my branch was downtown at the major clothing retail stores. That was, the focus was on clothing retail stores, not only because they're downtown, but also because most of the people who work at them are female, and women's laborers used to like make a lot of the clothing, right? So really focused picketing. That was from the union's point of view, but then you had all of these autonomous feminist organizations who were also doing their own roving pickets, right? So they were doing bicycle pickets, and they were going and having talks in the squares, and they were doing food points and things like this. So it was a little different in that there was less focus on closing shops and more on kind of being out in the middle of the street and getting together in public squares and doing like public eating together and things like this. So to the morning of the strike, it didn't look too much like a strike to me. There was a lot of shops that were open. People were going about, seemed to be going about their business. One anecdote that I could tell you is that I actually had a trial scheduled for that day for a union section that we had. And the lawyer on the case is a woman, and everybody in the union section was a woman, and I'm also a woman, and we really had to go to this trial. So the lawyer was very, very upset about it because she was doing a lot of legal work for the autonomous feminist coordinator in Madrid. But we had to go to this trial. And she went in the morning and she called me absolutely ecstatic that the central courthouse for social matters in Spain was closed for lack of personnel. So there were so many women on strike, so many people on strike, that they couldn't hold the trial. So that was pretty exciting. In other places that you didn't see it as much, right? I mean, trains were running on time, stores were open, things like this. I don't know if you'd like any more information, I can.
You were talking about a coordinator in Madrid. What was the feminist coordinator?
Okay, the feminist coordinator was born last year to organize this general strike, right? There was a call for an international general strike. I don't actually remember where this comes from, Argentina maybe even the United States. And they open up this coordinating assembly space, right? And this is all very 15th of, 15M. So people in Spain are very accustomed to getting together in these assemblies. So they call for a feminist assembly to organize this general strike. And it's on an individual basis. So I couldn't have gone as CNT, right? I could go as myself. And other unions and other political parties and political parties, feminist groups, etc., all went, but as people, right, to individually participate in this assembly. And its purpose was to organize this general strike, which it did. And part of that organizing the general strike was to get the unions to legalize the strike. This is where I come in.
Yes. So one of the things that, you know, like you said, it originated in another country, and there was stuff kind of happening in a lot of countries around the world, but it seems like it had a much bigger impact in Spain. What do you think caused that? And you know, was that related to the role of the unions, or can you say a little more about that?
Right. I mean, it's hard to say, like, that's a really tough question. Why did it have such a big impact here? And why were there so many people? Because I mean, the cherry on top of the 8th of March in Spain was these incredibly huge demonstrations. Like, incredibly huge. I don't think I've ever been in a demonstration that big, and there are lots of big demonstrations in Spain. Why was it bigger? I think because people have been developing, the feminist movement in Spain has been developing since 15M in 2011, and it's just been growing and growing and growing, and some of the other assemblies have faded out. So right after 15M,
It's been 15M. Yeah,
right, this is this process where there was a demonstration in Spain against for real democracy, I believe was the slogan. And after it, the police arrested a few people. And then people from the demonstration decided to camp out in the middle of the central plaza, the central square in Madrid, and stay there that night. And then they started calling people to come and stay with us, whatever, and they stayed one night, and then they stayed the next night, and then the next night, and then keep calling people to come and support us, whatever, and that grew into this huge political event where anybody who was interested in politics and everybody who wasn't interested in politics went down to the city center and participated in kind of setting up a permanent camp in the city center and also spreading out into these smaller assemblies. And they had, you know, there was a feminist assembly, actually one of the first ones that was created. These assemblies discuss and then made decisions on different issues, right? There was long-term politics, which all the anarchists were involved in. There was short-term politics, which all of the state parliamentary people were involved in, you know, things like that. So you would go to these big assemblies, and it was a pretty exciting time for people to start participating in politics and stuff. And the and I would say it's all based on anarchist organizing, right? But then they that kind of organizing set up these huge assemblies where they have kind of liquid-like agendas and things. Is what you would see. Like I went to the coordinator, the 8th of March coordinators assembly, which was also an open assembly. By open, I mean anybody can go. Like my union doesn't have open assemblies. We have assemblies for members only. You can't be at the assembly if you're not a member of the union. These assemblies are open, so you can go and participate and ask to speak and things. And it was just like a 15M assembly. There's like 300 people in a big room. There's a very small mic, and they have kind of a fast, spontaneous agenda happening. But of course, that it's hard to make. I mean, well, I have my criticisms of this model, but anyway.
It reminds me a lot of Occupy.
It's an exciting. It's like, because Occupy comes out of the 15M movement, right?
Right, yeah, I think Occupy took a lot of inspiration from that movement. But, you know, whereas Occupy kind of faded away here, it sounds like the 15M movement has created some roots in Spain that kind of took off with, like, the feminist coordinators.
Right, I mean, I guess we didn't actually think that it had. The roots weren't that deep. But then this 8th of March has clearly shown that, yes, they are deep and that they're still there because it's based on, it's the same model, right?
Hmm. So you were saying, you know, where the CNT kind of comes in is in legalizing the strike. Can you say a little bit more about what it means to legalize a strike? Why do strikes have to be legalized in Spain? And then also, like, once, you know, how did y'all get asked to legalize the strike? What was the kind of thought among the feminist coordinator about that? And then, like, how did things develop between the feminist coordinator on the one hand and the CNT and the other radical unions on the other hand?
I'll start with the end. Because if I forget to think of the beginning, you remind me. The coordinator was calling for a strike. They wanted a labor, so there it was four, at 4 points. It was a consumption strikes, i.e. don't go consume in stores or buy things. A taking care of people strike. So stop taking care of your husband, stop taking care of your child, et cetera, all of this reproductive labor that women do. It was an educational strike, so students should go on strike. And then there was a works, what they were calling a labor strike. What most of us would just understand as like a strike, right? But in the union, we understood it as, okay, that's the strike. They were calling for it long before they realized that they had to legalize it in Spain. In order for a general strike to not get everybody who does it fired, it has to be legalized and called by a union that has national representation. National representation means that that union is all around Spain. There are a lot of unions in Spain that are just regional, like just in the Basque Country or just in Catalonia or whatever. A general strike needs to be called by a national union. So the coordinator was sort of split, this is my interpretation, it was split between people who were pushing for the two very big business unions, which there's a communist and a socialist union, to call for the strike. Because if they called for it, it was going to be bigger on a labor side, and that's the truth, because they're the biggest unions. And then there was the other side, more radical political side maybe, that wanted the red and black unions or the combative unions to call for it. So we have like a Trotskyist union, COBAS, and we have CGT and CNT, the two big red and black unions. And then you have Intersindical, they're sort of, you know, I'm not really sure about their political leanings. The problem with Intersindical is they're not all over Spain. So which other unions did you have? USO, you had the kind of radical bus union, et cetera. Now I forgot your first questions.
Just real quick.
How did they get those like they asked us to legalize the strike? They actually officially sent delegates to our unions to ask us if we would legalize it. The I mean, it wasn't that official because lots of people from our unions were already participating in these assemblies, right? So women, the 8th of March coordinator was only open to women, right? So women from our unions would be going to these meetings and they were talking about legalizing the strikes, and our membership would come back to the union and be like, oh, we gotta legalize this. Like they wanna have a strike. They don't know what a strike is, but this is what they need. So we'll do it for them. And that's kind of how that worked out. They asked us to do it much later than it would have been possible for CNT to make the decision to legalize it. Because in order for us to make that decision, it has to be proposed by a union. That proposal has to go to all the membership. The membership all have to discuss it in assemblies, send their agreement, their resolutions to local meetings, and the local plenary has to go to a regional plenary, then the regional plenary has to go to a confederal, like a national level. So good thing we had people in that meeting, because otherwise I would never have gotten through this process. But it did. It was fun.
So you mentioned that like the two main unions in Spain are, there's a communist and a socialist one, which I think to people in the US that might sound like, whoa, like that's pretty radical. But then you said, you know, opposed to that, there's this other group of what are called like the combative unions in Spain, including the anarchist ones, but also other unions with different politics. What's kind of the division between, you know, the supposedly socialist and communist union on the one hand that are the main unions versus the more the combative unions, and how did that division play out like with this strike?
Well, the biggest difference here was that the two big unions are kind of partners with the state in Spain. So I believe this happens in a lot of different states in Europe, but you have, they would call like the different sides of the negotiating table. They're at the government table, right? So the communist union and the socialist union are involved in all sorts of legislative stuff. Anything that has to do with labor reform, they're involved big, like with, like they have like, they talk to, you know, they're on the president's line or whatever. All the other unions are not. That's part of why they're combative, right? Well, the big difference for the strike was that there was a general call for a 24-hour strike, a general strike, which is what these general strikes in Spain usually are. And the two big unions said, no, we're going to do two-hour stoppages. So they had it's interesting because they weren't actually really sure what they were doing, but on paper what they had done, because then I was in meetings with them and they weren't really sure, but on paper what they had done was call for, it was 11 to 1 and then 4 to 6 maybe, I think the two stops. So if you were in a morning shift or in an afternoon shift, you were able to walk out of work for 2 hours and, you know, protest.
Now, what I've seen,
it
seems like a lot of people there were saying, you know, that actually basically they were trying to sabotage the bigger strike, and especially by, you know, not only trying to call for a 2-hour strike, but or a stoppage, but doing it in the lunch hour or whatever, and not having every worker do it at the same time.
Well, that's one thing. One thing is that they were not responding to kind of a social movement asking for something, right? So the feminist movement in Spain, all over Spain, was saying, this is what we want. And the union, they said, no.
Right. I mean,
they said, no, that's not what we're going to do, and you don't know what you're doing, and like, there's nothing that pisses feminists off more than big, what they feel are masculine-dominated organizations telling them that they can't do something or whatever, right? I can understand that. The combative unions are like, this is what you want, this is what we'll do. Great. The sabotaging thing goes a little bit further than just the 2 hours. There's actually evidence, and we got this from membership, of these big unions sending official papers to people telling them that the 24-hour strike was not legal and that they would be fired if they did it. That, I mean, that there was like active sabotage going on.
Yeah. That's kind of interesting thinking about, you know, in the aftermath of the general strike that happened last year in Catalonia, where also the combative unions took the lead. And the you know, the main business unions, you know, at first weren't sure what they were going to do, and then basically said workers should ask their boss for the day off, but shouldn't actually go on strike or something like that, right? Maybe you can give a little more, a better description, but it seems like, you know, twice now in a year, the radical and combative unions have taken the lead in calling for general strikes that were actually fairly successful. Is that right? And what's new about that? What's significant?
It's really significant. We're very small unions. These are the big major players in the union field or whatever, and they have been completely discredited on like anything from the center to the left of the center. There's just no, they were booed out of the demonstration on 8th of March, at least where I was. I mean, not just from my union, but like everybody around us was like, these people are class traitors. And also they're, you know, filled with, I mean, then you get into the whole feminist discourse about who was doing what. I mean, in CNT, in the radical unions, for example, we had women union organizers give the speeches, and they had their secretary general, who was a man, give a speech. And when they asked him why his union has never had a female secretary general, he said society's not ready for a female secretary general when CNT had a female secretary general 15 years ago. So it's like, wow. You know, I mean, they looked so bad. They couldn't possibly have looked any worse. I'm not sure how that's going to play out in the long run, them being so discredited on the left. I don't know if they had too much support on the left anyway at this point. They end up representing workers just because. They don't have to have a lot of membership. They don't, they're kind of in part of the system at this point.
Sure. So I guess one thing
I'm not sure if that answered your question, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. One thing I'm curious about is, you know, now basically twice in less than a year, y'all have been able to call for fairly successful general strikes. This one you also, you know, worked pretty closely with these other social movements. How, you know, what kind of changed to allow that in Spain or in your unions? And then also, like, how have your unions been changing since that happened, right? Like, what, you know, how has the feminist general strike changed the CNT? Or how do you expect that it might have ramifications in the future?
I think the feminist general strike changed CNT in the way that it really jump-started the discussions about feminism in the union. That's one thing that's really important. I mean, we've all been talking about feminism for the past month and a half, and I do union organizing, I do workplace organizing, I do a lot of labor stuff, I do a lot of getting more people on board, et cetera. I don't talk too much about gender issues, right? And this, it became the issue, and we argued about it, and there was heated, you know, yelling and banging fists on tables and things like this. And that kind of stuff needs to happen in order for the organization to move forward. And I think it did ideologically in discourse. And then so that's one thing kind of on like the membership grassroots level. And then there's the, on the higher level of CNT as an organization, in order to legalize a strike, you have to, in Spain, you have to ask for something from the person you're going to go on strike with. And that person has to say no. So in this case, the person we're asking something from is the government. And we had to ask them for, we had to place some demands on the table, right? And we had to negotiate those demands. The work that went into thinking discourse-wise about what we were gonna ask for, kind of looking into what the 8th of March coordinator was also asking for, but we had to focus it only on legal issues, right? Labor issues, I'm sorry. And then adapting that and infusing that with anarcho-syndicalist ideology was, I think that was a really great exercise, kind of like revolutionary gymnastics on an ideological level. And I was lucky enough to go with the lawyer from the technical, we have a technical team with some lawyers and an economist. And I went with the lawyer to negotiate with the Employers Association. And the Employers Association, the National Employers Association, and the two big unions were there. As I said, they're like, oh, they're part of the government structure, right? And including it was a small owners association, and then like the big industrial owners or whatever. And the small owners association and the other two unions and the two women who were there to mediate, because you have a, look at this, is a state-sponsored mediation. They all came up to us afterwards and congratulated us on how thought-provoking and cutting-edge they thought, kind of the things that we were kind of digging up about how structural inequality exists in Spain through labor law and stuff like that, which was really pretty cool. And that, I was there for that. And then we also had to negotiate with political parties who would sit down to negotiate with us, negotiate, it's quote unquote. And the Socialist Party did, and she also congratulated the delegation that went, saying that CNT was really on the avant-garde of kind of gender, like labor gender discourse. So that was pretty exciting. And that work was kind of spurred on by the 8th of March calling for this general strike. We wouldn't have done that work if we hadn't had to get our ass in gear and legalize this. So that was cool.
That's really interesting. Can you say a little bit more about kind of what overall was being demanded by the 8th of March coordinator, and then how, you know, you're talking about the way that the CNT kind of had to adapt to that through revolutionary gymnastics. So I'd be curious to hear more about that as well.
We demanded four things. One was that the salary gap. There is a structural, there is a direct and an indirect salary gap. But a direct salary gap would be the exact same. I'm translating all of this from Spanish. I'm sure you guys have the same ideas in English. The direct salary gap would be you and I do the same exact job and I get paid less for it. Now that's illegal in Spain, so that actually doesn't really exist. Some places you might see it, right? You actually, where they usually see it is in direct and executive positions. And we toned that down and we said, we're not actually worried about the, what's it called, the glass ceiling so much because we don't want bosses, right? I mean, this isn't about, I want to be a boss. And there's a bigger problem, which is indirect salary gap. And that is this kind of complicated idea in that contracts in Spain, collectively bargained contracts or collectively bargained agreements in Spain, work in these gendered differences into payments into pay scale. They also work in who can get access to what kind of positions, right? So better paid positions, one of the best examples is like a better paid position will always require like open availability for time. So I can call you at 8 o'clock and you'll come in or whatever, right? Like mothers can't do that. So you'll never, it'd be very difficult for them to hire. They won't hire a woman for that job. So these are kind of ways that legally they can discriminate against women. So that's one thing, this is a salary gap. And there's the second one is related to that, and it's access to jobs and promotion within jobs. Another thing about availability. Can you come in? Do you have availability over the weekends? Can you travel? Do you have your own vehicle? Are you available to travel? Women from the ages of 25 to 45, 50, well, oftentimes they have people, they're taking care of, they're doing the reproductive labor at home, right? So they can't. That would keep them out of those jobs, and those jobs are better paid. And they also can't promote. We asked the government to do an analysis of this kind of situation. So that's two. The third one is work-life balance. Now in Spain, you get 4 months off for the birth of a child, and men partners get 15 days off. Our demand is that men and women get 4 months off, because otherwise all of the caretaking labor is on the woman for these 4 months. Also affecting her in her professional career, salary, income, etc., creating these inequalities to make real co-responsibility, right? And the fourth one is for Spain to sign the International Labor Organization's I think it's an agreement on domestic labor. You might know this better, Brandon. Which grants domestic labor the same rights as, sorry, like they are full, they're workers in the eyes of the law, right? So in Spain, domestic, someone who comes and cleans your house, a domestic worker, they're not actually workers in Spain. They don't have unemployment benefits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we asked for Spain just to sign this international labor. It's like kind of a glaring deficit in Spanish labor law. And it overwhelmingly affects women.
That's interesting. I'm curious if the US has signed that, because there's definitely different labor laws for domestic laborers here. So one thing you said was, you know, basically demanding for everyone to be able to get 4 months paid leave after a child is born. And, you know, one thing that it seemed like people were also trying to stress in the organizing for this strike is that this was a strike not just for women, but for everybody. You know, so that seems like a demand that probably a lot of men would want to get behind as well, like that improves their conditions as well. Did you all see, did a lot of, you know, what was the kind of, I guess, following of this strike beyond people of all genders, basically?
Well, it was actually a debate till the very, very last. The 8th of March coordinator up until like January, February, was saying they were only calling women to strike. In Spain, you can't only call one gender to strike. So a union can't legalize a strike for just one gender. And our union, CNT at least, I don't know what the debates were like in other unions, threw that out the window. We were like, no, everybody, this is a general strike, call everybody a strike. People who don't go on strikes are called scabs. we were pretty virulent about this. There was a little bit of conflict because the 8th of March coordinator was getting more media coverage than we were. And there were some spokespeople who were saying it was just for women, et cetera. And we were on the other side screaming like, no, no, everybody needs to go on strike, you know? But I was in a union meeting mid-February and a guy from the union asked me if he was supposed to go on strike. So there were, and he was like, well, there's a lot of misinformation. It wasn't very clear who was being asked to go on general strike, even amongst union members, which was horrifying to me. I was like, oh my God, this is gonna be ridiculous. And it was actually a great success. So it worked out anyway. I'm sorry, your next question, like people, would men support this? I mean, so I was the 8th of March coordinator asked all of the unions who were going to call the strike, legalize the strike, and supporting unions to meet with them, like a delegation in February. And I went to that meeting and they didn't think that men would be supportive of this strike. It was interesting. And I was there with a comrade who's a man, and he was deeply offended. And we felt that it was like, do you not know what solidarity is? This is called solidarity, of course. Because in Spain, I don't know how this works in the States, but in Spain, you go on strike, you lose your day's salary. And to a lot of people who are making minimum wage, that's rough. So she was like, well, do you know any men who would be willing to give their salary to support women's causes? And the two men at the table were like, of course! What a ridiculous question, right? I mean, then I've told this story to other people and they were like, well, maybe it's not actually such a ridiculous question, but I think it's sad if it isn't ridiculous. And definitely in CNT it was obvious. And the people who were asking me, if men who were like, should I go on strike? They said, if we don't do the strike, I'm like, what do I need to do to support this? How do I support this? You tell me how I'm supposed to support this. So, and there's been other collectives who, you know, people who had to do, there's this interesting thing in Spain called minimum services that are legally stipulated, where like buses and hospitals and, oh my God, I mean, there's like the most ridiculous amount of things that have minimum services. So even if people want to go on strike, they can't actually. These are negotiated with the union, blah, blah, blah. There's all this whole technical thing. That was also revolutionary gymnastics for us because we had to go to these meetings, which we've never been called to before, and negotiate with the government, quote unquote. As this kind of red and black union. anyway, so people who had to do these minimal services, they were signing up to give their salary to the cover possible fines or whatever. I mean, there was a lot of solidarity happening, even on people who were forced to not go on strike, for example.
That's really cool. So, I mean, it's like, obviously the strike had a huge following. You know, you said there was the massive demonstrations. The pictures look big, but you said they're bigger than anything you've ever seen in Spain. What's kind of been the conversation among people, you know, not just like radicals, but all sorts of people, like what's the kind of discourse after the strike, you know, and has anything happened since the strike or like?
Well, I mean, March 9th, it was like, the revolution's here! It's like, oh, you know, it's at 1 o'clock, it's coming, we gotta get ready, everybody sleep, you know. Not so much in our union, but definitely everybody around, you know. I was at the march with a bunch of girlfriends who have absolutely nothing to do with anything politics, and they were like, put in the CNT stickers, and they were like, give me that flag, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. They're really quite infectious, these people. So that was fun. That was a really fun part of it. And it made people feel like there was like something happening. And I think the biggest change, this is my personal view, but I think the biggest change is going to be on the discourse level, that feminism has just elbowed its way into dinner tables, and there it will be there to stay. So now, I mean, everybody's talking about it. One of the big changes we've discussed is like, it's now feminism in Spain used to be kind of an older women generation. So people who had fought Franco, right? They were like the real radicals. And then there's this kind of lull in feminism in Spain. I've been living in Spain for 15 years, and I remember when I first got here, I was like, what the hell? And now it's just gotten like there's been this explosion of a combination of all sorts of different, they talk about feminisms. So there's all these different, like queer stuff to, your second wave, a lot of second wave feminists to third to post to whatever. I mean, everybody's just like, everybody's got something to argue about, and it's a lot of political ideas getting thrown back and forth and a lot of passion, and everybody's talking about it. And I think that is kind of the biggest takeaway at this point. CNT particularly, we actually organize as a union most of the time. So the strike for us, I kept telling everybody it was like my third job, right? I had like a job and then I go to the union and then I had this other thing, which was to work on the strike. So I was exhausted. And now that the strike is over, I just like went back to just having two jobs, which was doing organizing stuff and working. We're trying to get a moment to sit down and actually have a meeting and do some, evaluations of what happened, but that hasn't happened yet at the union just because we're very, very busy.
Yeah, that's really
that,
great.
It won't have to happen though. Oh, the other thing that I do know, this goes back to your the coordinator. They are meeting. The coordinator was founded to bring together these different feminist collectives, or coordinate them, as the name implies. And they're having a meeting on April 6th to see where should they dissolve? Are they going to be? What are they going to do? They're going to keep. Are they going to work on a strike for next year? What are they going to do? So that on April 6th, that's coming up pretty soon. They'll discuss their future.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that really strikes me about this strike, no pun intended, is, with my experience in Spain, it seemed like the feminist discourse was at a much kind of quieter level than in the US, and there was just a lot less discussion about feminism. And in the course of a couple of months, it seems like Spain, feminist discourse in Spain has totally leapfrogged where it's at in the US, like through this experience of mass struggle. Does that seem right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible. I mean, I'm a woman, and I often get asked, I'm like, well, what is your take on this? Or you're a woman, go do this or whatever. But I really, what I do in the union is, more labor workplace oriented. That doesn't mean that one thing excludes the other, but I do a lot of, I just got fired. How much does my boss owe me kind of work? So, yeah, but they do. They definitely, I mean, and it also, it brought to the table, at least in our union, I mean, sorry to keep this like conversation so focused on CNT, but that's where I do all my political organizing. The conversation about the fact that like in my union, there's only like four or five really active women to 20, 25 active men. Why is that, right? Or the fact that for this strike, there's a lot of like women have to be first. And it was like, there were only five of us and we're like, oh shit. Like I have to be everywhere at once. This is really kind of stressful. there was a lot of discussion about like, I at first, for example, I just rejected that. I was like, fuck that, excuse my language. I'm like not, not being some token woman here. And then it got to the point when it was like, you sort of like women started to come out of the woodwork, for example, sorry, that expression sounds terrible, but like women who hadn't been participating in things, they got attracted to this. They were like, oh, well, okay, maybe I want to talk about this, or maybe I'll go to this meeting and things like this. And that, I think that it'll be really good for CNT to finally question like, so what the hell's going on? Why aren't there women in these actually really, to my view, very horizontal open spaces? So.
Yeah. So going back just a second, you were talking about this kind of generation gap of feminism in Spain, where for a long time feminism felt like an older women's thing, people who'd resisted Franco. I saw that there was recently an exposition that y'all opened in Madrid about the Mujeres Libres. I was hoping you could say a little bit about that. Like, what was that group? What's their legacy for Spain and, their relevance for today?
Okay, so this is an exhibition that CNT's Cultural Association opens. It was curated, sorry, by one of the women who works at the cultural center. They have all the archives for CNT from the 30s. Well, not all of them, actually. Some of them are in Amsterdam, sorry. But most of that work is there. So they have a lot of access to original Mujeres Libres documents, Free Women of Spain. And she was interested in them. So this organization comes up in 36. Now, if you like the Spanish Civil War is from 1936 to 39. So this is a pretty kind of amazing period. And it's a segment of women in the Union who decide they need to have a women's specific anarcho-syndicalist group within CNT, right? Which is different from kind of the feminist stuff that's happening in Spain right now, which is cross-class, cross-ideology in some ways, starting to define itself as, I think it came out of the strike as being anti-capitalist and things like this, but not so purely anarcho-syndicalist like Free Women. They came to have 20,000 members at least in 30 by 39, and there was 141 sections around the country. Like, it's pretty amazing. It was just like in the middle of a fucking civil war. What did they do? They were really focused on education and training women for jobs, getting women to be economically independent. This is kind of like the second wave feminist focus. They were anti-prostitution. They were trying to get women to get other jobs and be economically independent through other forms of work. They were anti, what do you call that? Like pro-birth control. So they did a lot of sexual education to get working women to not be like, have 14 children and things like this. So they did a lot of sexual education and birth control stuff. Once again, have I mentioned this was during the Civil War? Kind of amazing. They also taught women how to fire guns and you know, handle rifles so that they could go fight on the front. They were there also criticizing kind of male-dominated politics in CNT at the time. They had a congress in 37 in Valencia. They're amazing. They're pretty. It's pretty amazing. The work that they did is pretty amazing. What happens in 39? Well, Franco wins fascist takeover. I mean, where the hell are they going to go?
What's like with the current generation of feminists, especially people that are coming to this, you know, from this, these more independent feminist movements, do they, like, is there any resonance of the Mujeres Libres? Like, do people see that as a precursor in any kind of way?
There's not actually that much information about Mujeres Libres from the 30s available. There's a American author, I believe.
Martha.
There you go. She wrote like kind of the definitive book. She brought the issue kind of to the forefront. It's, you know, somebody had to come to Spain and explain it to them. Well, not explain it to them, but I also think it's like, you know, 40 years of fascist dictatorship would do a lot to erase memory. It's one of the big struggles here on the left is to recover memory. And, but Mujeres Libres became back in the 70s, just like CNT did when Franco died. It was a big organization, but then CNT split into two different unions at the fifth Congress. What Congress was that? Anyway, one of their Congresses in 80 something, and CGT, which what is now CGT, left CNT. And with that, the Mujeres Libres that had been forming also kind of splintered. But there are still Mujeres Libres organizations. In some places, they're stronger than others. And in Bilbao, northern in the Basque Country, they were, I guess, most of the people in this, the feminist assembly were from Mujeres Libres. That, I mean, in Madrid, at least, when I was in the Madrid assembly, there were a lot of people from left-wing political parties, for example. Mm-hmm. And in Spain, there's a clear difference between anarchist politics and parliamentary politics on the left. So, you know, for us to be in an assembly with political parties, it's like, so you can kind of see. But they were there. It was fine. The assembly was fine. They followed the rules.
Cool. Well, you know, one thing you were mentioning is that you in particular are involved in a lot of kind of smaller day-to-day struggles in like workplace focused, you know, focusing on organizing at specific workplaces. It seems like, you know, there's a lot of this happening in Spain in the last couple of years, a lot of new workplaces where workers are organizing. You know, do you see ties between these like quote unquote smaller struggles and then something big like the feminist general strike or what happened in Catalonia last year? And like, if so, what ties do you see there?
Oh yeah, definitely. Because I mean, everybody it doesn't matter who you are in Spain, you saw that the only unions that legalized the 24-hour strike were CNT, CGT, and then a couple other radical Marxist-y unions, right? And that was all over the news. All over the news, all over the daily news, like on TV and the press or whatever. It was clear that we were the ones calling for it. And what was successful? It was the 24-hour strike. So if you come out of that and you're like, well, what labor union is going to support me? Well, these guys are going to support me. The other ones are not, right? Like I asked, you know, there was this huge social movement. It's not one person. A huge social movement is asking for something. And it like no skin off your nose. Well, no skin off your nose, but a big union, really not very much skin off your nose to call this general strike. And they were like, nah, we're not going to do it. You know, how much do you think they're actually going to support you in your day-to-day struggles? And so when you said like, well, have you guys been, what's your takeaway from the strike? It's like, we've had, I guess, 2 weeks since the strike, right? I'm looking at my calendar. No, just last week, we opened the union for labor consults once a week. And there were so many people in the union. I don't think I've ever seen the union like that either. And when I talked to other branches in Madrid, they said the same thing. So that is definitely off of the strike. It was just like, we were filled with people. You know, I just, you know, I heard about you guys and I thought I'd organize at my workplace or, you know, any range of stuff. So hopefully, I guess the task we have at hand now is to be able to be big enough and flexible enough and agile enough to be able to handle that. If like thousand, if a hundred, even if, I mean, we have a group of eight people who do, I'm calling them labor consults. What would you call that? People come in and they have questions about their work.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't have anything like that in the US.
Okay, so it's like maybe like a work center. So we do where we open our doors from like 4 hours every Tuesday, and people can come in, and we have it on our website and stuff, and they can ask us, you know, like from my boss is harassing me too. I just got fired too. Me and five other people are so pissed off with our boss. We want to form a union section. What can the union do to help us, right? That's what we do on Tuesdays. And we have a group of maybe eight people in the group is people who can answer these sorts of questions. So you have some technical knowledge and then you have strategic knowledge about how to take these cases on. And every single one of us was busy with a group of workers the entire evening, and that never happens. It was crazy. It was just like in and out and in and out. And I was like, okay, well, you gotta come back next Tuesday because I got three people hanging out the door. Like, we're gonna, great, call me. And here's your membership form.
It's a great problem.
So it is a great problem. So I can't really tell you, what do you think about Eighth of March? I'm like, I don't know. It was great. So hopefully, yeah, I hope that some of the seeing, you know, being out there and being part of that and responding to what people need, because one of the things that union people come to us will tell us is that they've been to the bigger unions and that the bigger unions are just like, oh, I can't take on your case, you know, it's just like a four-person case, or there's only 10 of you, you know. So they'll come to us and we're like, let's do it, we'd love to take on your case, the revolution's coming closer every second.
Yeah, are there any like particular kind of smaller struggles that you think are like emblematic of you know, what's been happening in Spain, or things that have prepared y'all to do something big, like take on this general strike?
Well, do something big, like take on the general strike. It was so high level that there was like, I actually work a lot more at the union local level, like work as in time and personal interactions and things like this. The general strike was more kind of the legal nitty pitty stuff. The legality of it, the following of these different things, and making sure that the strike wasn't illegalized so that everybody who went on strike was safe to go on strike, right? We're just kind of giving people the legal coverage that they needed. And that was kind of different footwork than I usually do. And I didn't do any of that, actually. They sent me to meetings and stuff because I live in Madrid. So your other question was, how does my...
Like, are there any, like, smaller struggles that you think are kind of emblematic of what's been happening recently in Spain, you know, kind of that kind of symbolize some of the recent movements or that, you know, really prepared y'all for this?
Well, here's something that comes to mind really fast. So last Tuesday, we're at our union hall. We've got all these consults and all this stuff. And usually people are fearful right? The basic thing is fear. People are afraid of their employers because, this is my interpretation, that there's so much unemployment in this country, you don't want to lose your job, right? So people are scared, and really we have to be like, you're not going to lose your job, I'm going to make sure you don't lose your job, and we're going to improve your conditions, right? And last Tuesday, instead of people being scared, we had two groups of workers who actively asked us if they could do strikes at work.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I mean, it made it like, now people are talking about striking, right? So these guys from a theater, three of them came in, and they were like, there's 14 of them that work at this theater. They do, there's like a musical, kind of like Broadway kind of thing. There's 14 people total, technicians and actors. And four of them came in, and they think another three could have joined the union as well. And these things only last for 2 months, right? So their employer hadn't paid them their overtime in their last paycheck. And they were like, we're striking on Saturday. They just joined, and they were like, how fast can we do this? How fast can you legalize this strike? And we were like, we need 5 days. So it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of like how infectious strikes can be, right? Like, when people see them winning, then they can imagine themselves doing it.
Right, and feeling empowered. Like, often people are like, well, demonstrations, you know, they're just demonstrations, and who cares? I'm one of these people, right? I'm like, oh, it's a fucking demonstration. Like, but being in a demonstration empowers you, and it makes you feel empowering in the very like basic sense of that word, that I am powerful. We can do stuff, you know, and there's a lot of us, and it's not just me. There's lots of us, you know, because like the worst thing that could happen is when you have someone come in and they're like, oh, my coworkers are idiots. When everybody says that, it's like, oh my God, like you're never going anywhere. But when you are, you don't even have to like your coworkers, right? You get out and you're like, this huge demonstration happened. We all striked, and we all struck. And stuff, and people are excited, and they're like, strikes work, and we can strike, and we can do this together, and, you know, the union's gonna back us, and we're safe, you know, because they were safe during the strike, because people were scared to strike before the strike. Like, am I gonna get fired? I'm not gonna get fired.
I mean, one thing that you're talking about, which I think is a super important point, is like, you know, beyond the kind of spectacular stuff of like going on strike, there's all the day-to-day, like knowing how to keep people from getting fired and knowing how to keep, you know, follow up and make sure that people don't lose promotions and that kind of thing, right? And I think we're seeing something in the US right now where everybody has seen the successful West Virginia teacher strike, and I think especially a lot of teachers are now able to imagine going on a successful strike, and, you know, whereas there was decades of fear prior to this, but, you know, I think at this point, kind of one of the key tasks that we're going to have to figure out how to do is to actually show people like, yep, you can not only go on strike, but we'll have an organization to have your back afterwards, right?
Exactly. Like, we're here for you. Like, we are the organization that's here for you. And that, for me, kind of my, like, I have a sort of a debate with autonomous movements is like, you need an organization. I mean, even kind of left, like insurrectional anarchists, right? Versus anarcho-syndicalists like ourselves. You need an organization. We need to be there for certain, like things like this. I need to have an office where people can come to every Tuesday afternoon. And I need to have a lawyer that works on our team. So she's like drawing up strategy and things like this. And,
you know, I think one thing also is like, sometimes it's really hard to imagine these things happening until they do, right? Like, it would have been hard to imagine a statewide teacher strike in West Virginia. It would have been hard 6 months ago to imagine a feminist general strike in Spain being as successful as it was, you know, and it feels like it's very hard to imagine anything like this happening in, say, the US or Canada. But, you know, like I just said, it would have been almost impossible to imagine it in Spain. What do you think, like, people in the US and Canada or other countries that want to see something like this happen could do to actually bring it about?
In Spain, the feminists, the autonomous feminists, knew that they were going to have a strike, and that they were going to, I mean, they weren't even that involved. They weren't even that invested in it being like a labor stoppage. They didn't really care if it was that big or not, that part of it. But they were sure that the 8th of March was going to be a big freaking day. I mean, and we knew that the protest was going to be enormous. Like, we knew it. So you can kind of feel it, you know. I was the big thing I was surprised about was that some places were actually closed. Like, there was a lot of journalists who didn't show up for work. So like news didn't have, there were no female newscasters, or like I said, the courts and stuff were closed because all the women were gone. That was interesting. That's also, I mean, we'd have to look at it from a class perspective, right? See, these are upper middle class professions. Highly educated women who are right? Getting in, so for me, how do we talk about feminism to real working class minimum wage people who are the people who are actually in my union, right? Most of the people. So
it wasn't the clothing retailers that were closed.
They weren't closed. And like, actually there are people in my union, like union sections and CNT who didn't go on strike, right? Who are earning minimum wage and they thought about it. They weren't sure about it, right? So how do we now, like for me, how do we bring all this kind of high talk of like feminism just to confuse everybody and bring it down to like, okay, what does this actually mean? And let's translate this to, you know, cause then if you talk about it to people or like these women on this one particular union section, they're like, yeah, that's not fair. That's totally unfair. I'm like, right, that's so unfair. So, but you have to bring it to that. I mean, like, we have to talk about it like that. It can't be, I don't know. Sometimes I get a little overwhelmed too with the debates going on, which if you're a journalist or you're a lawyer or you're a judge, it's not so hard for you to get involved in, right? But we're gonna have to work on, but those are also positions of power. So when you, they're also positions in the media. So what the strike looks very, like the strike was really successful because people who were able to control that kind of, how that information got out to society, there were a lot of women or like people in very informed, highly educated women there. Not to be a downer on your parade here, Brandon, I'm sorry. All right, but it wasn't like all the domestic workers went on a strike and they did not, you know.
Sure.
But of course, they would get fired. That would be pretty hard for us to protect them. Like.
So one other thing that kind of struck me is you mentioned like feminism in Spain kind of came out of this being overwhelmingly anti-capitalist. Which seems, you know, I think there's some similar dynamics to how this looked compared to like the women's march that happened in the U.S. last year, you know, right after Trump's inauguration, in terms of how massive that was. But that seemed to kind of pull feminism more towards like incorporation into the Democratic Party, whereas this, from what you're saying, you know, Spanish feminism now is more radical. Is that right? And right. And what do you think was kind of the difference there?
That's a theory, right? I would back that. I like that idea. I mean, I was very, very pleased in the demonstration. It was like, this is a really radical march. And there was so many people, right? A very right-wing party in Spain, a new right-wing, you know, so you have this new left-wing party that comes up after 2011, Podemos, and then you have, shortly thereafter, a very far right-wing party as well. And one of the women in the party, Arrimadas, she was in an interview and they asked her if she was going to go on strike. And she said, well, you know, I support women's issues, but you know, I don't support anti-capitalism. And that was key to defining the strike as anti-capitalist. And she was perfect. I was like, thank you for saying that. Right. Because whereas the feminist movements weren't being open about that, she underlined it and they got it all out there. And it was like, oh, okay. So it's anti-capitalist, and everybody was like, well, duh, but they hadn't been saying it, right? So you had to get the right to really expose you.
That's great.
Yeah. And I mean, it became like, that was the talk of for like the next week. Everybody was like, well, we wouldn't want to go on strike because it's anti-capitalist. Like, duh.
Yeah, we need to do that in the US.
Well, it was also like, you know, the Women's March wasn't a strike, though, right? It's just a march. And I think part of like an interesting or a good thing to do the way that this was focused. And this also has to do with a lot of very far left wing women pulling these autonomous assemblies, kind of Malatesta like to their side, is that focus on labor, right? And like working class people, and that this is a working class issue. And, you know, if you're a part of the working class, on the left, you're anti-capitalist, right?
Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to discuss? Any information that you think people should check out? Like, how can people find out more about what happened in Spain or, you know, what's happening now?
If you can read in Spanish, our CNT's website, or even if you can't read in Spanish, there's a lot of great pictures up on it. It's nosotras.cnt.es. So nosotras. CNT.es. The website's awesome, and there's a lot of great pictures. And if you can read in Spanish, there's all of our official line and things like this, which will be a little lighter than my personal commentary. A cool thing that just happened this weekend, yesterday. So Saturday the 20, what is this? Saturday the 17th of March, was that the pensions in Spain are like under attack from the right-wing party, right? And older Spaniards have also gone out into the streets, and there have been these huge demonstrations and all this stuff. And a really cool thing happened yesterday was that they had, the pensions organizations had called for a demonstration, and the 8th of March coordinator seconded the call, asking everybody, all the feminist organizations, to support the pension. So that's like a fusing of struggles or whatever. So that's pretty cool. I think that, I don't know, could be exciting. We'll see what happens.
That is exciting. It's really cool to hear that the struggles are already kind of merging together.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.